Executive Power, Disc 6.
Chapter 34. Coleman and Wicker had descended the mountain without incident, and then very slowly and deliberately worked their way through the thick jungle with the goal of linking back up with Hackett and Strobel. Using the various paths that snaked their way through the plush vegetation was unwise, so even though they were going mostly downhill, it took a full 2 hours before they reached their comrades. The last 100 or so feet was navigated on their bellies. Thanks to their secure Motorola radios and GPS devices, they were able to locate the well-concealed Hackett and Strobel without needing them to reveal their position. The two former SEALs had picked a spot atop a small ridgeline among the roots of a large mangrove tree. Their vantage of the Abu Sayyaf camp was ideal. When Coleman reached the hide, he was surprised to find how lax the enemy's security was. A cooking fire puffed smoke into the air, and the men lounged about with no apparent concern that they might be attacked. At first glance, there appeared to be no perimeter patrol. Coleman took this as further evidence that General Morrow had been under their payroll. Looking through binoculars, he counted 4 dilapidated lean-tos and 2 green tents that appeared to be of the U.S. Army surplus type. 2 men were busy tying down a blue tarp over one of the lean-tos as they prepared for the storm that was coming. The color of the tarp was further evidence that, contrary to the intelligence reports they'd seen, these guerrillas were not a crack outfit. Coleman guessed the site was an abandoned village of some sort. Methodically, he scanned every foot looking for the Andersons. He checked each dwelling and saw no sign of the family. This meant they'd already been moved to a different camp, or they were inside one of the army tents. Coleman prayed it was the latter. Knowing they had a long day ahead of them, Coleman ordered Hackett and Strobel to get some shut-eye while he sent Wicker to reconnoiter their left flank and see if he could confirm the location of the Andersons. As Wicker squirmed away, the former commander of SEAL Team 6 got wrapped on the secure net and began the process of meticulously relaying the location of each structure, the precise terrain of the camp, and the exact strength of the enemy. Neither man communicated the obvious. Come nightfall, they would be launching one of the most delicate and challenging of all military operations, a hostage rescue. Unlike almost every other military engagement, this one needed to be exercised with great restraint. It needed to be carried out with extreme skill and precision, or the hostages would get mowed down in the crossfire. The expansive non-skid deck of the USS Belleau Wood pitched and rolled as the seas intensified with the oncoming storm. Standing on the aft section of the flat top, Rapp picked up a suppressed MP5 submachine gun that was lying on a tarp with several others. He held the weapon in his hands for a second, getting a feel for the balance, and then pulled back the slide. After checking the chamber, he released the cocking lever and listened for the click of a 9mm round being chambered. In front of him were 8 cardboard silhouette body targets. Rapp thumbed the selector switch from safety to single shot. He paid no attention to the men who were standing behind him. Moving with the confidence of someone who had done this many times before, he brought the weapon up into the firing position. His right foot moved slightly in front of his left. His entire body crouched a bit and he leaned forward. With the butt of the weapon nestled firmly to his left shoulder, he looked down the black steel and through the hoop sight. The ship rolled under his feet, and with his knees flexed, Rapp found the rhythm. He squeezed the trigger once, and a bullet spat from the end of the thick black silencer. 30 feet away, the projectile tore a hole in the center of the head of the paper target. Rapp squeezed off 2 more rounds that enlarged the hole created by the first bullet. Then, flipping the selector switch from single shot to fully automatic, he began moving down the line, spraying the targets with lead. Each paper silhouette varied in distance from 30 to 50 feet, but it didn't seem to affect Rapp's marksmanship. By the time he reached the end, all 8 heads were shredded. Pausing for only a second, Rapp did a speed load on a fresh 30-round magazine and started back down the line, this time shooting with one hand and moving at a much quicker pace. When he reached the end, he stopped and analyzed the fresh set of holes he'd added to the chest of each target. Satisfied with the weapon, he turned to the chief and said, "This one will do just fine." Lieutenant Jackson, who'd been watching with great interest, smiled and said, "Not bad." Rapp grinned. It was easy. They weren't moving. As Rapp walked toward the superstructure, Lieutenant Jackson fell in. "Do you want to tell me what you're up to?" "What do you mean?" "Somehow I get the feeling you're not going to sit this one out on the sidelines." Rapp kept walking toward the superstructure. He'd been on autopilot all morning, diligently putting the op together. It was now after noon, and things were gelling nicely. Coleman had confirmed that the Andersons were in one of the army tents. Both SEAL platoons were ready, the insertion had been planned, the backup was in place, and the extraction was ready. Now all they had to do was wait for nightfall. The only thing that was left for Rapp was to be honest with himself. He was drawn toward the action like a surgeon to the operating room. He didn't have to go. Coleman and his men were some of the best in the world, as were Jackson and his SEALs. But as good as they were, Rapp knew he was better. And Coleman would be the first to admit it. Rapp knew if he didn't do everything in his power to save that family, he'd never forgive himself. Anna would never understand that, but she didn't have to know. That, combined with being on the other side of the planet, made it easier to make the decision. "Yeah," said Rapp, "I'm going." One concern had consistently come up in the operational planning meeting. The Abu Sayyaf group that was holding the Andersons was not the only guerrilla element on the island. The way they were armed made it highly unlikely that they were the force that had ambushed the SEAL team several nights earlier. With that in mind, Jackson was concerned about landing his platoon on the beach. Like any leader, he had no desire to lead his team into an ambush. The most readily available solution to the problem was to be inserted by helicopter farther inland, as Coleman and his men had been the night before. Rapp, however, ruled this out immediately. Neither Jackson nor Captain Forrester knew the real reason why Coleman and his team were on the island. They both thought it was to track down the Andersons. If they knew the whole story, as Rapp did, they would probably come to the same conclusion. And that was that Coleman's helicopter insertion had more than likely spooked the Andersons' captors into moving them. If the guerrillas decided to move again, the rescue would have to be postponed until another plan could be drawn up. Coleman offered to send one of his men on the 3-mile hike back to the beach to check things out in advance of the landing, but Rapp also ruled this out without hesitation. He wanted Coleman and his men focused on the target. If the guerrillas decided to move again, he would need all four of them on the hunt. There was also the remote possibility that they might be discovered by the guerrillas, and if that happened, Coleman, minus even one man, could mean the difference between survival and annihilation. There was a readily available solution to the danger of the landing. Rapp had been tossing it around in his head for several hours and decided now was the time to make it known. Looking at Jackson, he asked, "How tall are you?" Jackson looked a little confused. 5'11", why?" Rapp gave him the once-over from head to toe. 175 pounds? 178. Good. Rapp slapped Jackson on the back and said, "You wouldn't mind lending me some of your gear, would you?" Chapter 35. Rain fell in heavy sheets as the United States Marine Corps CH-53E Super Sea Stallion helicopter cruised toward its destination. The wipers worked furiously to clear the cockpit windscreen, but it was useless. The pilots were flying by instrument. At a standstill, visibility was a scant 200 feet. But flying at 110 miles per hour, it was reduced to zero. Fortunately, the wind was manageable. The slow-moving front had stalled over the Philippines, dumping rain from Manila in the north to Davao in the south. Nothing was moving that didn't have to. While most people sought cover and either cursed Mother Nature's power or watched it in wonder, there were those who embraced it. 25 such individuals sat in the back of the cold, sterile cargo hold that was designed to carry up to 55 Marines. All were dressed in black neoprene scuba suits. 24 of them were U.S. Navy SEALs, and one was an employee of the CIA. The rain was a real blessing, enabling Rapp to move up his timetable and launch early. Nightfall was still several hours away, but you couldn't tell, emboldened by the weather and the updates from Coleman that it looked like the guerrillas had settled in to wait the storm out, Rapp jumped at the opportunity to get things moving. He considered alerting Kennedy that they were starting the op, but decided against it. It was 3 in the morning in Washington, and that would involve waking her up and then bringing her up to speed. He had neither the inclination nor the time to open the door to suggestions from the strategists and politicians back in Washington. At this point, they would more than likely complicate the mission. As far as getting final approval went, he wasn't worried. The precedent had been set when the president authorized the rescue operation earlier in the week. The United States wanted its citizens back, and the aggressors would pay. The original plan had been to take 2 Sea Stallions, load up the operators and 4 Zodiacs, and drop everyone off 5 miles from the beach 1 hour after sunset. When the front finally moved in, Rapp consulted with the pilots and Jackson. The pilots felt the storm would mask their approach to the point where they could get in close enough to drop them 1 mile from the beach with no fear of being spotted or heard. Rapp and Jackson had no problem coming to the same conclusion. Lose the Zodiacs and put everyone on one bird. These types of operations were complicated enough. Any chance to simplify was an opportunity that had to be taken. The men were more than capable of offloading the Zodiacs in the roughest of seas, but it was nonetheless something else for them to do, and then once ashore, they would have to take time to stash the boats. All of this was preferred to a 5-mile swim when they were up against the clock, but that was no longer an issue. A 1-mile swim for the men was nothing. One of the crew members came through the cabin holding up 2 fingers. There was no sense in trying to yell over the 3 turbine engines and 6 rotor blades. Those who hadn't already strapped on their fins began to do so. At the 1-minute mark, the back ramp of the big chopper was lowered into the down position. On Jackson's command, all the men stood and steadied themselves as best they could. At the back ramp, one of the crewmen was tethered to the chopper by a safety harness. He leaned out the open hatch and called out the bird's slow descent via the in-flight headset. The pilots could see almost nothing through the windscreen. Instead of holding a true hover, the bird crept forward at 5 miles per hour. This was intentional, so the men wouldn't land on top of each other as they entered the water. At 10 feet above the drink, the pilots decided they were close enough and ordered the crew chief to get the men out. In 2s, the warriors, wearing their big black fins, waddled like penguins to the sea. Jackson counted the sticks as they jumped off the ramp, and when he and Rapp were the only 2 left, he grabbed the spook by the shoulder, and in they went. As the helicopter climbed into the storm, the men paired off and lined up for the swim to shore. A quick head count was taken, their position was verified by GPS, and compasses were consulted. Jackson ordered them to move out, and the 25 waterborne warriors began slicing through the water. 300 feet from the beach, the formation halted. The landmass was but a darker shadow through the curtain of rain. Jackson briefly tried once again to send in 2 of his combat swimmers to reconnoiter the beach, but Rapp overruled him and took off on his own. Using only his feet, he kicked his way through the salty water until his hands touched the bottom. He took off his dive fins, secured them, and then removed and stowed his mask. Reaching under the neck of his wetsuit, he grabbed and donned the headset of his secure Motorola radio. Lastly, he retrieved his suppressed MP5 submachine gun from the swim bag and took it off safety. He'd outfitted the weapon with an AN-PVS-17 night vision sight, and after turning it on, he did a quick check of the jungle. He'd opted for the gun-mounted scope over wearing the goggles. The reasons were twofold. First, it was harder to shoot wearing the goggles, and second, there was a good chance the goggles would help to precipitate a headache. He'd rather trust his eyes and use the gun-mounted scope as he needed it. Warm, fresh water pelted his face as he looked up and down the beach. There was nothing but the rain. Rain splashing into the water about him. Rain pelting leaves of the jungle. Rain hitting the beach. It was a serene, steady patter that would deaden almost any man's senses if exposed to it long enough. Rapp was counting on it to put the gorillas to sleep. So much rain had fallen that the beach was streaked with gullies of water pouring from the jungle. Rapp stood there in the water, his senses alert to all that lay before him. After less than a minute of observation, he decided the chance that Abu Sayyaf was keeping an eye on this one spot of beach in this torrential downpour was minuscule. The seals had been killed the other night because of an intelligence leak, and this time he'd made sure no such leak could take place. After picking his spot, he radioed back to Jackson that he was going feet dry. Holding the MP5 in the ready position, he came out of the water and darted across the 50-odd feet of white sand and through the first line of palm trees. Standing next to one of the long, bent trees, he paused and listened. After 10 seconds of silence, he moved a little farther inland and worked his way up the beach and back. Satisfied that the landing area was clear, he radioed for the others to come ashore. A few minutes later, Rapp watched as four heads appeared out of the mist. The four seals stayed partially in the surf and trained their weapons on the jungle, while behind them other black-clad men began rising out of the water two at a time. Each pair of swim buddies ran up the beach, some faster than others, depending on their loads. In less than a minute, the entire element was off the beach and concealed. As per plan, a defensive perimeter was set up, and the men began donning jungle fatigues and boots while dive fins were collected and buried. The wetsuits were kept on under the camouflage BDUs to help preserve body heat. It would be a long night in the rain, and even though the temperature was in the 80s, being soaked for so long would slowly sap the men of their valuable energy. After donning his fatigues, Rapp pulled a floppy camouflage hat down over his head. Drops of water poured from the brim. Suddenly the wind picked up. With it came a roar through the trees, and the rain intensified. The drops falling from his hat turned into streams, and Rapp's thoughts turned to Coleman. He and his men would be soaked to the bone by the time they hooked up with him. Adjusting the lip mic on his headset, Rapp toggled the transmit button on his digitally encrypted Motorola radio and spoke.
"Strider, this is Iron Man. Do you copy? Over."
Rapp waited for a reply, cupping a hand over his free ear.
"Iron Man, this is Strider. What's your situation?"
"We're on the beach and about to move out."
"ETA?"
Rapp looked down at the rain-soaked ground and then up at the rising terrain. What would normally be a 40-minute hike on dry ground might easily now turn into a 3-hour jaunt. Rapp tried to remain optimistic.
"If we don't run into anybody, I'm guessing 2 hours. Maybe a little less."
"We'll be here."
"What's your sit rep?"
"Same as last time. No one's moving."
Rapp was tempted to ask him how he and his men were doing, but decided not to waste their time. Coleman would say they were fine, regardless of how miserable they were. Jackson appeared at Rapp's side.
"My point man has already found a path and everyone else is ready to go."
Rapp nodded and covered his lip mic.
"Let's move out."
Taking his hand off the mic, he said,
"Strider, we're on our way. I'll give you an update in 30 minutes.
The first squad of 8 seals started up the narrow footpath into the thickening jungle, with the men spaced a little closer than security would normally dictate. Jackson and the second squad, along with Rapp, came next, and then the third squad brought up the rear. All 25 heavily armed men quietly disappeared into the jungle and the pouring rain. Chapter 36. Something wasn't right. David's eyes fluttered open for a second and then snapped shut. The air was thick with dust and his ears were ringing. Having no idea where he was or what he'd been doing, David tried to sit up but couldn't. Again he blinked his eyes open, this time only to a thin squint. All of his senses seemed to be off, with the exception of his sight, and even that was a little blurry. David rolled his head to his left and saw nothing, and then to his right, where through the clouds of dust and smoke he saw fire. The flames jogged his memory. He was in Hebron at the meeting. The attaché cases were filled with the Iraqi counterfeit money. He had stepped outside and climbed into the armored car with Mohammed Atwa and then detonated the cases. A smile crept onto his lips as he remembered the look on Atwa's face when he'd stabbed him in the neck. David remembered the blood spraying from the man's throat. What a joy it was to see genuine horror on the face of a man who had brutalized thousands. His eyes fluttered. The haze lifted a bit. He tried to move his left arm, but it didn't budge. He struggled with his right arm, and after a moment it broke free. David lifted his head and realized that his lower body was covered in rubble. His thoughts again returned to the attaché cases and the explosives. The technicians at Mossad must have packed even more C4 than he'd expected into the cases. The entire house where the meeting had taken place appeared to be leveled. David held his head up and looked up and down the street. The destruction was massive. Half the block appeared to be destroyed. The attaché cases could not have done all this, he thought to himself. Then he remembered the noise. A noise he had only heard once before, but a noise that was impossible to forget. With one of his arms free, David propped himself up and looked around. His head was awash with pain, and either his ears were ringing very loudly or there were sirens blaring not so far away. From his new vantage point, he took in the devastation and was shocked to see the utter destruction. At least three homes, in addition to the one where the meeting had taken place, were completely demolished. Piles of rubble, with pockets of smoke and flames. The reality of what had happened hit David like a building had fallen on him. He did not mean for all of these innocent people to be harmed. The attaché cases would have been more than enough to handle the job, but that bastard Ben Friedman wanted to make absolutely sure that he killed everyone. He'd tracked him to the meeting. This was not a surprise to David. The fact that Friedman would try to follow him was a foregone conclusion. But David felt the man would not press too hard for fear of blowing what already amounted to the best gift he had ever been given. Somehow he'd managed to follow him and then to make sure no one made it out alive, including David. He'd launched missiles into the neighborhood. That was the noise he'd heard right before everything went black. The horrible, shrieking noise of a missile, a harbinger of death and destruction. David cleared several smaller stones from his legs and then a few larger ones. Where his black dress pants were torn, he could see blood mixing in with the dust from the stones that had covered him. Slowly and carefully, he pulled himself out from under the remaining rubble and took an inventory of the various pains that were shooting through his body. The ringing was still in his ears. David looked around in search of an emergency vehicle, but saw none. He came to the conclusion that the explosion had probably damaged his hearing. Carefully, he tried to stand, but quickly found that all was not well with his right leg. David placed only a fraction of his weight on it and hobbled over to what was left of a parked car. The destruction was horrendous. Half of the block was leveled, and of the homes that were still standing, most were either burning or in danger of catching fire. The number of innocent people killed would be enormous. It was time to flee. He did not want to be around to answer the questions of whoever it was who showed up, whether it was the Palestinian Authority or the Israelis. As David limped gingerly down the sidewalk, skirting rubble and leaning on whatever he could find for assistance, he saw an opportunity. Ben Friedman undoubtedly thought he was dead. Maybe there was a way to use that to his advantage. David picked up the pace, wincing in pain as he put more pressure on his bad leg. Through the smoke and the dust, he spotted a woman wandering toward him with a blank expression. As he neared her, he noticed she had something in her arms. The look on her face told him she was in shock. Resisting the urge to approach her, he pressed on. When they were within a few feet of each other, he glanced at what was in her arms and instantly wished he didn't. He wanted to believe the tiny, frail body was that of a doll. But he knew better. It was a baby. And David knew the poor infant would be visiting him in his dreams for years to come. Peace did not come without a price, he told himself. He continued saying this over and over as he hobbled away from the scene of devastation. Ben Friedman would someday answer for his callous brutality. It didn't have to happen this way. The children did not have to die. David knew the perfect way to hurt such a man. All he had to do was get to America. Once there, he would put into motion a series of events that would bring about the birth of a Palestinian state and the end of Ben Friedman. Chapter 37. Coleman was one of those steady types, never too up and never too down. He had an air of quiet authority about him that commanded a respect among his men. He was never overbearing or brusque, just calculating and decisive. But right now, more than anything, he was wet. The poncho that was draped over him had long ago become useless against the torrent of rain that was coming down by the bucket. The ground was so soaked, it was as if he was sitting on a plump sponge. With the onset of nightfall and the deluge of rain, visibility had been reduced to the point where they could no longer see the enemy camp. Coleman had moved Strobel and Hackett to a forward position an hour ago to keep an eye on things. They'd reported back exactly what the former SEAL team commander had expected, that nothing had changed. With their report in mind, Coleman dispatched Wicker on a mission to circumnavigate the camp so he could get a better feel for the entire area. As a general rule, when the weather was inclement, people stayed put. It didn't matter if it was the South Pacific or the South Bronx. It was human nature to seek shelter and try to stay either warm or dry or cool, depending on the conditions. SEALs were the exception to this rule. Knowing that they could and would be called on to perform an operation at a moment's notice, regardless of the weather, they took it upon themselves to train in the worst of conditions. It was also why they had to endure Hell Week during this election process. Candidates were deprived of sleep for days on end and marched continually into the cold surf of the Pacific at all hours in soiled, sandy uniforms. Most of them could handle the physical torment. The academic rigors were challenging but not overtaxing, and the verbal assaults from the instructors were for the most part ignored. It was the cumulative effect of all of these, however, that got to the SEAL candidates. By the time Hell Week arrived, they were already in a weakened state. Their bodies were sore, their nerves were frayed, and then the very bedrock of mental stability was jerked from underneath them. They were robbed of sleep and warmth, and when the human body is deprived of those two basic necessities, individuals began to do strange and unpredictable things. This was when most of the men broke and rang the bell, signaling that they were dropping out. To the average citizen, waking up a group of young men by slamming metal trash can lids together at 2 a.m. was cruel enough. But after you added in the fact that the men had just gone to bed 30 minutes earlier and had not been allowed more than an hour of sleep in 3 days, it seemed downright inhuman. But the SEALs weren't looking for just anyone. There was nothing nice or normal about warfare. It was mentally and physically exhausting, and it was all done without the comfort of a bed, a hot shower, and warm food. Most important, it was unlike almost any other job for one plain reason. You couldn't just quit. If you were working for the airlines and you got sick of throwing heavy suitcases around, you could at a moment's notice walk away from it all. If you didn't like your boss at work, you could easily quit. In Scott Coleman's world, however, there was no quitting, because quitting usually meant that you had to die or someone else did. That, more than anything, was what Hell Week was about. The men who ran the Naval Special Warfare Center in Coronado needed to find out who could take it, because in the real world of special operations, quitting was not an option. As miserable as Coleman was right now, he took a small amount of comfort in the fact that he'd been in much worse situations. He did have to admit one thing to himself, however. He wasn't a young stud anymore. Now that he was past 40, it seemed there was a new ache added to his list every month or so. He'd led a hard life for almost 20 years, and it was catching up with him. As he leaned against the base of a hardwood tree, he could tell his lower back and knees had stiffened considerably. He looked out into the faint gray light and checked his watch. The sun wasn't even down yet, but it might as well have been. Coleman judged his visibility was a scant 20 feet. Fishing a small packet from his pocket, he tore it open and popped 2 Nuprin into his mouth. The anti-inflammatory drug would help ease the aching in his back and knees. Rapp and the other warriors would be arriving shortly, and it would be time to move. Suddenly, a whispered voice carried through the air.
"Coming up behind you, boss."
Coleman heard Wicker's voice and turned to see the sniper standing just 10 feet away. The fact that he had gotten so close unnerved the commander. Either he was slipping, or Wicker was the sneakiest little bastard he'd ever met. Coleman got to his feet, and looking at the diminutive Wicker, said, "You know, that's a good way to get shot." Wicker smiled, his teeth a brilliant white against his camouflage-painted face.
"You have to hear me in order to shoot me."
"How long you been standing there?" demanded Coleman.
"Long enough to watch you pop a couple of pills."
"Shit." Coleman shook his head.
"Boss, don't sweat it. With this rain falling, I could sneak up on a buck and kill it with my knife."
"I bet you could," Coleman thought. Wicker was a hunter of both the 4- and 2-legged variety. Having grown up in Wyoming, he'd hunted everything from caribou to black bear to timber wolves.
"What did you find out?" "I don't want to come off as being too confident, but I think I could have walked right through their camp unnoticed."
"You serious?" asked Coleman.
"Yeah. It's this rain. It dulls the senses. It dampens the travel of noise to start with, but then after several hours like this, it becomes hypnotic."
Coleman nodded while he thought of something Rapp had said on the radio earlier.
"What about that ridge on the other side of the camp?" "A couple of footpaths, and that's it."
"No sentries?"
"None,"
Wicker said with a disgusted shake of his head.
"And I took my time. I mean, they don't have a single person out checking their perimeter. They're all sitting in those shacks or under the lean-tos. It's a joke these guys didn't get their asses kicked off this island a long time ago."
"Well, when the guy commanding the opposing force is in your back pocket, it makes things a little easier." Looking through the mist in the direction of the camp, Wicker added,
"I think the 4 of us could go in there right now and get this done."
Coleman suppressed a smile. He'd already thought the same thing, but he'd prefer to wait for the additional 25 shooters that were on their way. With a little luck, they might be able to pull it off, but if there was a single miscue, they'd get treaded.
"Any other observations?" "Yeah."
Wicker tilted his head back, looking up at the dark sky through a hole in the canopy. Raindrops pelted his face.
"I don't think this thing is getting any weaker. In fact, I think it's intensifying."
Coleman agreed, and looking skyward, he said, "The gusts are definitely more frequent."
"And stronger."
With caution in his voice, he added,
"If it gets worse, we might want to think about a different way to get home."
Just then, a strong gust swept the treetops, shaking loose a curtain of rain. Coleman looked toward the ground to avoid getting his face doused, and instead got a stream of water down the back of his neck. It had already been a long, wet day, and now it looked like things were only going to get worse. Chapter 38. Rapp was relieved to see Coleman. He wasn't crazy about jungles. They were great for concealment, but that went both ways. Behind every tree and bush loomed the threat of death. Moving through a jungle, even in the best of conditions, was physically draining. The humidity, the bugs, and the heat all took their toll, but that wasn't the nastiest part. It was the manifestation of paranoia that really wore you down. The psychological toll it took on your nerves was far greater than the way the heat and humidity sapped your strength. The constant threat of ambush or booby trap meant that every single footfall on the path was taken with trepidation. Every bush and tree potentially concealed an enemy waiting to cut you down. Throughout the 2-hour march from the beach, Rapp took comfort in the fact that Coleman kept reporting that the enemy appeared to be sitting the storm out. Hopefully, any of the MILF guerrillas on the island were doing the same. An ambush was unlikely, but a booby trap was still a real possibility. They'd stopped twice for brief breaks so Jackson could get a head count and check in with Coleman. The storm seemed to gain strength as they made their way inland. Both Rapp and Jackson understood what this could mean, and they'd already discussed it with Captain Forrester. Back on the bridge of the Belleau Wood, Forrester had a much better handle on the big picture. Gale force winds were now buffeting the flat top with speeds hitting 40 miles per hour, and that wasn't the end of it. The ship's meteorologist was giving even odds that the front might turn into a full-blown tropical storm with winds hitting 70-plus miles per hour. With the increased threat, the amphibious group was now steaming toward Surigao Strait and the relative protection of the leeward side of the island. The weather had been an asset until now, but it could quickly become a hindrance to a very important part of the operation. Jackson's men were spread out in a defensive perimeter around Coleman's position. Radio silence was to be strictly obeyed unless there was something important to report. This had nothing to do with the fear of their conversations being intercepted. Neither Abu Sayyaf, MILF, or the Philippine Army had the technology to decipher their transmissions. Radio silence was simply standard operational procedure so the commanders could concentrate on the task at hand and keep the airwaves open. Brief introductions were made. Rapp had already brought Jackson up to speed on Coleman's distinguished Special Forces career, and Coleman was still connected enough to the teams that he personally knew all of Jackson's commanders. "To start things off," said Rapp, looking mostly at Jackson, "I want to establish the chain of command." Glancing at Coleman, he continued, "Scott, you're running the show. No offense, Lieutenant, but he has more experience with this type of stuff than you."
"No offense taken,"
Jackson replied with sincerity. He was not so dumb as to think he was going to give orders to the former CO of SEAL Team 6, retired or not. Wicker was brought in on the discussion to try to give them the best picture of what they were up against, and then the four men headed off through the soaked jungle to get a first-hand look at the enemy encampment. Coleman alerted Hackett and Strobel to expect visitors. A short while later, four rain-soaked figures slithered on their bellies into a position just abreast of the other two men. It was now so dark that the recesses of the camp could only be seen with the aid of night-vision devices. Rapp placed a wet eyebrow up against the rubber cup of his gunscope. He was treated with a picture of the camp illuminated in shades of green, gray, and black. It was pretty much what he'd expected from listening to Coleman's reports. Four ramshackle lean-tos and two large tents. Faint light shone from under the bottom of both tents, and the lean-tos were lit with lanterns. From their position, Rapp could see directly into two of the lean-tos. He counted 8 terrorists in one structure and 9 in the other. Taking his eye off the scope, Rapp asked, "Which hut has the hostages in it?" Coleman was wearing a pair of night-vision goggles with a single protruding lens, the type that made the wearer look like an insect.
"The one on the right."
"Anyone in there with him?"
"There was."
Without looking away from the village, Coleman asked Hackett who was lying next to him.
"Kevin, how many tangos are in the tent with the family?"
Whispering, he replied, 8, at last count."
Coleman relayed the number to Rapp, who estimated the size of the hut and then tried to imagine how the people would be laid out inside.
"Is the total enemy count still at 60?
"Give or take a couple," replied Coleman.
Rapp looked at the 2 tents and 4 huts. If the numbers were right, he'd accounted for 25 of the 60 terrorists. That left roughly 35 others divvied up between the other tent and the 2 lean-tos. Fortunately, it appeared those 3 structures could be assaulted without the hostages being caught in a crossfire.
"What are you thinking, Scott?"
Coleman took a while to answer. He'd been thinking about his strategy all day.
"We send 2 four-man teams around each side of the camp. They take out the lean-tos, while a 4-man team takes out the 1 tent and a 5-man team handles the rescue."
Rapp ran the numbers. "That leaves a cover force of only 5.
"We could increase the cover force if you want to just lob grenades into the other structures, but my guess is you won't like that."
Rapp frowned. He instinctively disliked anything that made too much noise. It might attract some unwanted attention.
"Shit," answered the young lieutenant on Rapp's other side. "Who's going to hear it on a night like this? Besides, we're going to have to blow some trees to clear a landing area for the choppers."
This was a part of the plan that Rapp had never much liked. there was a small clearing about a quarter mile from where they were that was to be used as their extraction point. In order to make it big enough for a CH-53 Sea Stallion to land, they would have to enlarge the landing area by attaching explosives to at least a half dozen trees and shearing them off. It was sure to attract some attention, storm or no storm. I'd prefer to avoid the grenades if possible. Coleman flipped his goggles into the up position and looked at Rapp.
Then we stick with a 5-man cover force.
Rapp still seemed not entirely enamored with the plan.
Trust me on this. We'll use one of the saws to hit the big tent and take the other two and set them up for cover. In addition to that, I'll be up here with Kevin and Slick Wicker. They've already got their line of fire figured and the camp divided into 3 sectors. If anything pops up, they'll take care of it before you even know it's a problem.
The saw Coleman was referring to was the M249 squad automatic weapon. A light machine gun, the saw was capable of firing up to 700 rounds per minute, and in the hands of a trained operator, the weapon could lay down a withering amount of suppressive fire. Rapp nodded. You know more about this stuff than I do. Flashing his teeth behind his painted face, Coleman smiled and said,
Yeah, you're a real Girl Scout. Let me take one guess where you're going to be doing all this.
Rapp allowed himself a small smile.
Coleman knew him well.
Let's get back to picking your plan apart for a minute.
Nope. Not until you tell me what you've got planned for yourself.
You know where I'm going to be. Someone has to go in there and check things out before we hit the tent.
Aren't you married now?
Asked Coleman in a smart-ass tone. Rapp ignored him. Coleman knew the answer. Let's get back to the CP and put the finishing touches on this thing before the storm gets any worse. Chapter 39. Rapp didn't like what he was hearing. Odds were a big thing to him. He was by no means risk-averse, but he liked the probability stacked as much in his favor as possible. Invariably, what bothered him most were things that were out of his control, and the weather was typically one such thing. Captain Forrester had just informed them that the storm was, in fact, growing in strength. Gusts were now topping 60 miles per hour, and until they got around to the other side of the island, all flight operations were suspended. Forrester assured Rapp, however, that the extraction was still on. The captain maintained that his pilots could handle the winds. The ride just might be a little bumpy. This did absolutely nothing to assuage Rapp's concerns. Bravado and blustering were one thing, but reality was something entirely different. Could the captain's pilots pull off the extraction? Yes, was the answer, but could they also crash? Most definitely. Nighttime helicopter operations were delicate even in calm weather, but throw in a little wind, rain, and a mountainous terrain, and you had a recipe for disaster. As Forrester spoke of the competency of his aviators, the CIA counterterrorism operative was acutely aware of one vital statistic. More U.S. Special Forces personnel had been killed in helicopter accidents in the last 2 decades than in all other mishaps combined. Rapp, Coleman, and Jackson were all kneeling under the relative protection of a large, dense tree. Covering his lip mic, Rapp looked at Coleman and said, I've got a bad feeling about our extraction. Rapp could tell immediately by the look on Coleman's face that the man shared his concern.
I'm not crazy about it either. But what are our alternatives? Do you want to wait to see if this thing blows over and go in just before first light?
That option also didn't sound good to Rapp.
No.
We're not going to wait. Now's the right time to hit him.
We brought along plenty of explosives,
offered Jackson. We could try expanding the perimeter of the landing area.
That might help, conceded Rapp, but I'm still not crazy about getting on a helicopter in this weather.
Coleman was struck with an idea.
What if we march back to the beach? That's fine if we're not pursued, or worse,
Jackson pointed over his shoulder toward the Abu Sayyaf camp.
If they manage to get off a radio transmission that they've been hit, we could get cut off on our way to the beach, and even then we still have to get on a chopper.
Not necessarily, said Coleman. Thumbing the transmit button on his radio, he asked,
Captain, what are the seas like on the leeward side of the island?
There was a brief delay while the captain radioed one of the ships in the group that was out ahead.
Right now we're looking at 10-foot swells.
He knew the answer to the next question, but asked it anyway. Any problem launching the Mark V's in those seas? No. I can turn the ship into the storm and we'll have no problem.
What do you think? Coleman looked at Rapp. If the takedown goes off clean, we can have the captain launch the Mark V's and meet them on the beach. It'll take us at least an hour to get there. That should give them more than enough time to launch the boats and pick us up. We can bring the boats right in on the beach, load up and head out to the Belleau Wood.
And if we run into any resistance, added Rapp, or we think they've alerted their comrades in arms, we call for the helicopter extraction.
Exactly, answered Coleman.
Rapp looked at Jackson. What do you think?
I like it. It gives us some options to work with.
Good.
Coleman was also relieved. Lifting the handset of the secure radio, he said,
Captain, here's what we're going to do.
While Coleman worked out the details with Forrester, Rapp took the opportunity to discuss something very delicate with Jackson. He hadn't given the subject much thought until he'd got a good look at the enemy camp, but now, in light of the fact that they might need more time to get off the island, the sensitive issue needed to be dealt with. Rapp looked the younger man square in the eye. Lieutenant, have you ever seen combat before? Jackson hesitated briefly, as if he'd been waiting for the question.
No,
he finally admitted.
That's all right, replied Rapp. We'll have to start somewhere.
How many of your men have seen action? Again, Jackson hesitated while he tallied the number.
5 of the 23.
This was not exactly what Rapp wanted to hear. In his mind, he started moving people around like pieces on a chessboard. Hackett's experience was too valuable to attach him to the cover force. His steady gun would be needed down where the action was taking place, and for that matter, it would be nice to have Coleman at his side, too. The only problem there was that Coleman needed to be in a position where he could take in the whole picture. Coleman got off the radio with the captain, and Rapp apprised him of his concerns. Before considering them, Coleman asked Jackson to bring his men in for a final briefing. When the young lieutenant was gone, Rapp said, "He's never seen action." Coleman seemed unfazed by the revelation.
"It doesn't surprise me."
With a detached look in his eyes, Rapp added, "I'm going to need some hardened guys down there with me to mop up when we're done." The two men looked at each other and communicated an unspoken thought.
"Yeah, I know," said Coleman. "No prisoners, no survivors."
He'd been through the drill before. "I'll make sure I communicate it to Jackson and the chiefs. Believe me, he's green, but he's heard it before."
"Yeah, hearing about it's one thing, but until you've had to put a bullet in a wounded man's head..."
Rapp frowned and looked down at the ground. "It'd be nice if we could spare the kid from having to think about it for the rest of his life."
Coleman agreed. "Don't worry. I'll take care of it."
Jackson came back to the group, and his men started appearing through the underbrush. When everyone was assembled, Coleman and Jackson began briefing the men on the specifics of the mission. Few questions were asked. The men had all gone through the drill before. Contingencies were addressed, and for a final time, they went over handling the hostages and getting them out of the line of fire and secured as soon as possible. Coleman went on to state, in very clear terms, this was more than a hostage rescue. He explained to the men that if they wanted to make it back to the ship, they needed to decimate the enemy. They were an inferior force in numbers and could offer no aid or quarter. The men had all heard this before from their various instructors. But for the majority of them, it was the first time it held such relevance. The last thing Coleman did was point to his own forehead and say,
"Remember, double taps to the foreheads and keep moving."
Then one by one he ordered each element to their jumping-off points. Coleman then directed the cover force into position, and when everything was ready, he gave the word to move out. Rapp led the group up the middle. Crawling on their bellies, they slid from their elevated position down toward the rushing creek. Before the rains had come, the creek could have been crossed with one step. Now it was a raging, waist-deep river that would have to be forded with caution. Even with the cover noise of raindrops hitting the thick jungle leaves, the men moved with great care. Footing was so slippery that everyone had been ordered to crawl, lest someone slip, go tumbling down toward the creek, and possibly alert the terrorists. Behind Rapp followed Lieutenant Jackson and 10 of his men. The remaining 12 SEALs who were not assigned to the cover force were now working their way into position to flank the camp. As per the scouting report that Wicker had given them, 6 men had gone to take a position on the west end of the camp and 6 more to the east side. These 2 groups were to watch the 2 main paths that led into the village and then strike the 4 lean-tos when the order was given. All 29 men in the operation had been briefed on the entire scope of the operation. This was crucial, not just so that they could carry out another man's assignment if he fell, but to understand where everyone else was. With so much firepower concentrated in such a small area, the men needed to be aware of what the various elements were up to, lest they shoot one of their own. When they reached the overflowing banks of the creek, Rapp waited to hear from the 2 flanking elements that they were in position. He looked out from under the brim of his jungle hat across the rain-peppered rushing stream and toward the village. From his vantage, he could see directly into one of the lean-tos without the aid of his gun-mounted night-vision scope. The men inside appeared to be playing a game of some sort under a single hanging lantern. At the moment, one of the men appeared to be yelling at one of his companions about something. The others stood about and laughed boisterously at the angered man. As Rapp watched, he couldn't help but think that the discipline of this group was really lax. It was really an embarrassment that someone hadn't freed the Andersons sooner. While waiting for the go-ahead, Rapp's thoughts turned briefly to his wife. If she knew what he was doing right now, she'd cut his nuts off. Instinctively, knowing that there was probably a pretty good case to be made that he was an irresponsible and somewhat dishonest husband, he decided to not explore the issue further. At least, not for now. The awkward denials and recriminations could wait until he was back in Washington. It was always questions with Anna. She had an insatiable desire to know things, and the more she was told something didn't matter, the more it mattered. This trait, of course, treated her well in her job as a reporter, but in their relationship it was something that had to be monitored closely. Anna was a very passionate woman. Nothing was done in a half-hearted manner. If it was worth doing, it was worth doing to the fullest. In this regard, Rapp wasn't all that different. He just went about things in a more analytical, stoic way, whereas Anna was more passionate and determined. Coleman's voice crackled over his earpiece, pulling him back to the present.
Teams 3 and 4 are in position, Mitch. Let me know when you're ready.
Cradling his suppressed MP5 in his arms, he edged forward, entering the rushing water head first. The force of the stream rushing down the mountain was stronger than he thought it would be. He hoped it wasn't any deeper than his waist, or they might have a more difficult time getting across than they'd planned. As the water deepened, Rapp found his footing and carefully picked his way across, ready to drop down into the water at a moment's notice if someone appeared from one of the 2 tents. Fortunately, the water never got above the middle of his thighs. As long as none of the other men lost their footing, they would have little difficulty in fording the stream. When he reached the other side, he crawled up the grassy bank and took up a cover position a mere 30 feet from the hostages' tent. Using hand signals, he gestured for Jackson to bring the other 2 teams over. This had been Jackson's idea. The original plan was to send Rapp over on his own and see if he could get close enough to the 1 tent to somehow tell them where the hostages were positioned inside. They all agreed that most likely the Andersons were huddled together at the far end of the tent. Nonetheless, it would be nice to know exactly where they were. SEALs regularly trained in shooting rooms set up for hostage rescues. They'd have to burst through a door, window, or sometimes even a wall, and in a matter of a second or 2 differentiate between the hostages and the terrorists and then kill the latter. Jackson's suggestion had been to get the remaining 2 teams across before Rapp tried to sneak a peek. This way, if things went wrong, they'd be in a much better position to execute the takedown. No one wanted to return without the Andersons, so Jackson urged that they hold nothing back. Rapp looked over his shoulder and saw Jackson reach his side of the creek and then gesture for the next man to follow. As he waited for Jackson to join him, he was startled by a flash to his left. Rapp's whole body tensed as light spilled out from the other tent. Looking through the grass, he saw a man holding back the flap of the tent and relieving himself. Rapp didn't bother to train his gun on the man. He knew Wicker would have already done so. Looking over his shoulder, he could barely make out one of Jackson's men crouching down in the middle of the rushing water. With no fear of being heard due to the falling rain, Rapp whispered into his lip mic,
"Everyone relax. This guy can't see more than 20 feet."
When the guy finished his business and let the flap of the tent close, there was a collective sigh of relief. The fording continued, and before long all of the men were across and in position to move should Rapp be discovered. Sitting atop the slight ridge, just 200 feet from the village, Coleman had an unobstructed view. He'd watched intently as Rapp and then the others crossed the rushing stream. Both flanking elements were not visible as they worked their way through the jungle. Wicker had already scouted that terrain and reported that it was free of booby traps. When each element was ready, Coleman spoke to Rapp.
"Mitch, when you're ready, go sneak a quick peek and then get out of there. Lieutenant, have your conga line ready."
The conga line Coleman was referring to was an entry technique the SEALs used. The men lined up as if dancing the conga and then entered the structure, every other man peeling off and responsible for clearing a given area within the room. It was a tried-and-true technique used by all hostage rescue teams. Whispering into his mic, Rapp let Coleman know he was going in. Crawling through the grass, he inched his way forward toward the tent. Now out in the relative open, protected only by darkness and rain, he moved quickly. Across a muddy path and then up a slight slope of shorter grass, he was careful to keep the barrel of his weapon clear. Less than 10 feet from the tent now, he began to hear voices. He continued toward the far side of the tent, where the Andersons were most likely situated. He was now within the stakes. Carefully, he crept up to the edge of the tent. A thin sliver of light spilled out from under the green canvas where it floated just above the wet ground. Rapp made no effort to look under the side at first. Instead, he repositioned himself so he was lying in the right direction and listened to the voices. Over the din of the rain pelting his hat, the tent, and the ground, he could barely make out the voices of men speaking Filipino. Rapp crawled toward the other end of the tent, and the voices grew louder. He also saw shadows cast from the interior down along the gap at the bottom. Satisfied that they'd guessed right, he scooted backward through the grass and mud to the other end. Before looking under the side of the tent, Rapp stared momentarily at his suppressed MP5 with its night vision scope and long 30-round magazine extending from the underside. If he had to shoot, the weapon might be difficult to bring up under the side of the tent. Rapp laid the weapon down on the ground in front of him and reached for his silenced 9mm Beretta. After quietly drawing it from his thigh holster, he held the weapon lightly in his left hand. Unlike the movies, there was no need to chamber a round, take the weapon off safety and cock it. Rapp operated with his weapons hot at all times. He listened for another moment, but gleaned nothing further. If the hostages were inside, they weren't making any noise. Cupping his hands over his lip mic, he whispered,
"I'm going to sneak a peek. Be ready to move."
Twisting onto his back, he positioned himself so he could look under the side by pulling the bottom up slightly with his right hand, leaving his left hand free if he needed it. Laying his head almost on the ground, he took a look. He was rewarded with nothing more than the sight of the rotten wood boards that served as a floor for the tent. Cautiously, he lifted the side of the tent, only an inch at first, though he was confident that the wind and rain would conceal any noise that he made. Rewarded with an up-close look at a dirty foot, he paused, not knowing if it belonged to a Filipino or an American. Raising the side another inch and pulling it out slightly, he saw part of a hairless calf encrusted in mud and bug bites and a separate foot that was so small it could have belonged only to a child. Rapp's spirits instantly rose, and he pulled back the bottom of the tent a little farther. As in the other tents, a single lantern hung from the ceiling. In the dim light he spied two of the children and the back of the mother, their red hair making them instantly recognizable. Rapp continued to scan for the father and the other child, knowing exactly where everyone was would allow them to execute a clean takedown. Rapp thought he could make out part of the father's leg on the far side of the tent. Pulling on the side a little more, he lifted his head to try to get a better angle. Suddenly, he was met with a pair of wide eyes, and that was when it happened. Chapter 40 Coleman watched everything from his perch. Even in the relatively warm air, he was chilled. He ignored the physical signs that he needed to find a dry, warm place. His body had been through worse. Even at his age, he knew he could tolerate quite a bit more. Silently, he urged Rapp to hurry. It was important that they verify the position of the Andersons, but it was not imperative. He'd never gotten used to the anxiety that went along with these types of operations. That was probably a good thing, but one would think that after all the operations he'd been part of, it would get a little easier. Looking through the scope of his M4 carbine, he watched Rapp draw his pistol and then roll onto his side. Then he heard Rapp's voice warn everybody to be ready. Coleman kept the scope on Rapp. His finger was nowhere near the trigger. If things got hot, his eyes and commands were more important than his shooting skills. That was unless they were routed into a full retreat. In Coleman's mind, that wasn't even a possibility, not with surprise on their side and the skill of the shooters he deployed. As someone who had often commanded men in battle, Coleman had a real feel for when things weren't going well, and conversely when they were. So far, all seemed to be going very well. That sentiment instantly died when a scream came clamoring over his earpiece. Coleman instinctively winced at the sound of something so ominous and unwanted. Before he had a chance to find out what was going on, Rapp began shouting orders over the net. Rapp saw the look of fear begin to form on the face of the young red-headed girl cradled in her mother's arms. In an effort to forestall the inevitable, Rapp smiled at the girl and mouthed the words, "It's okay." It was about this time that he remembered his face was smeared with green, black, and brown paint. He could smile at this young child all he wanted, but it wouldn't change the fact that he looked like a monster coming to get her and her family. As soon as the little mouth started to open, Rapp knew what would follow. He hesitated for only a fraction of a second and then brought his gun up just as the girl let loose a blood-curdling shriek. A subsonic 9mm round spat from the end of the silencer, striking the nearest kidnapper in the side of the head, instantly dropping him into the lap of the man who was sitting next to him. The terrorists were sitting around a rickety table, and for the briefest of moments, they froze. With a tone of urgency, but not panic, Rapp shouted the go word over and over into his lip mic as he moved from one target to the next. His gun moved as an extension of his arm, efficiently seeking out targets, sweeping from left to right. The pistol carried 16 rounds, one in the chamber and 15 in the grip. Each depleted round registered in his mind as its brass casing was ejected. He got off 3 clean headshots before the tent became so filled with terrorists diving and lurching every which way that he had to resort to aiming for chests and backs. One of the men got hold of his weapon, and Rapp shot him in the shoulder, sending him sprawling and the gun clattering to the floor. Remembering Jackson and his men, Rapp yelled, "Spray down the right side of the tent! The hostages are all down by me!" The last thing he wanted was to hit one of them with a stray bullet as they came through the tent, or worse, have one of them hit him coming the other way. Rapp saw 2 muzzles coming around. One was tracking toward the hostages, but Rapp couldn't get a clear shot. A body was in the way, screaming, "Shoot at the damn tent!" He squeezed off 3 quick rounds, directed at a target he couldn't fully see. The terrorist teetered backward, the dead body of his comrade knocking him off his feet. His finger squeezed the trigger on the way down, sending a 3-round burst tearing through the wall and roof of the tent. Rapp saw more movement to his right. His eyes moved faster than his gun. He saw the flash of the rifle muzzle, and then the wood floor in front of him splintered with the impact from a bullet, followed by another flash and another. The man was shooting the assault rifle on full automatic, shredding the rotten floorboards before him. Rapp rushed his first shot, hitting the man in the shoulder. He needed only a split second more to place the terrorist's head in his sights, but he never got the chance. The searing pain of a bullet slammed into his flesh, sending his shot wide of the target. Before he could react to what had just happened, a fusillade of bullets ripped through the canvas wall of the tent, sending the terrorist who had just shot him into a spastic, sideways dance. No fewer than 6 shots propelled the man over a plastic chair and to the ground. The bullets did not stop coming for another 5 seconds, over 100 of them in total. Rapp finally called out for Jackson and his men to secure the hostages. Keeping his weapon and eyes trained on the mass of bodies at the other end of the tent, he tensed as the first wave of pain radiated to the extremities of his every limb. He watched as Jackson's men came into the tent. Several quick shots were fired from the end of the thick silencers, but most of the work had already been taken care of. They were just mopping up. Letting his head rest on the ground, he looked over at the huddled family in the corner. He was about to call out over the radio that he'd been hit, but stopped. The other elements would still be in the thick of it. Coleman didn't need the distraction just yet. No. Rapp decided he would just lie there and relax for a bit. Chapter 41. A slight headache gnawed at the base of Kennedy's brain. She knew in truth it was due to the second cosmopolitan that she'd had with Anna Rapp. It had been worth it, though. Her private conversation with Anna had broken through some barriers. The two women had reached an understanding of sorts. Mitch was their link. They both loved him, and if they truly cared about him, they would make the effort to get along. Kennedy was magnanimous in her understanding of Anna's plight, but insistent that Mitch would not be happy leading the indolent lifestyle of an intelligence analyst. He was an incredibly talented individual who just so happened to be in the business of counterterrorism. His skills and his commitment had aided countless individuals and led to the prevention of death and destruction. Now, as Kennedy was returning to the scene of last night's festivities, she wondered how she could look like anything other than a liar to the woman whose confidence she had just gained. She'd gone to great lengths to calm Anna's fears over her husband's safety. Speaking with true conviction in regard to Rapp's talents and penchant for survival, she'd told Anna that Mitch had been involved in much more dire operations and that he, in fact, would be nowhere near the point of battle while on his current mission. Since he had already succeeded in eliminating General Morrow, she felt this was close enough to the truth. Others would be taking care of the hostage rescue, and Mitch would be monitoring the operation from a safe distance. That had at least been her understanding of how things would proceed. All that changed when her phone rang this morning at precisely 5 a.m. Jake Turbis, the director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, awoke his boss to inform her that the operation in the Philippines had been a success. This fruitful conclusion to an international situation was all a very big surprise to Kennedy, since the operation wasn't supposed to have begun yet. After thanking the director of the CTC and giving him no sign that she'd been somehow left out of the loop, Kennedy pulled herself from her bed and went straight to Langley. When she got there, the puzzle of what had occurred, some 6,000 miles away, began to fall into place. The mission had been a complete success. The Andersons and all of the operators were safely on board the Belleau Wood, sitting out a rather ferocious tropical storm, and there was only one injury to report. All things considered, Kennedy should have been very pleased with the outcome. On the surface, she appeared her calm, cool self. Nodding at the right times and asking only the most pertinent of questions, but inside, she was seething. Someone had been shot, and as luck would have it, it was none other than Mitchell Rapp. Kennedy was furious. How in the hell did Rapp get shot when he was supposed to be sitting on a warship 10 miles off the coast? And more important, why in the hell was the timetable for the rescue operation moved up without her knowing about it? Kennedy resisted the urge to call General Flood and ask if he'd given the green light. She would need some time to gather her thoughts, and her intuition told her that Flood had also been left out of the loop. Asking half-cocked questions that she didn't know the answers to was a good way to invite inquiry into how she ran her agency. Mitch Rapp was going to have to answer some very tough questions when he got back. Kennedy's only solace right now was that, ultimately, Rapp would pay for his cowboy attitude far worse at home than he would at work. At Langley, he was the golden boy, capable of doing no wrong. A mythology had been structured around him. He was a walking, talking legend. A man with rugged good looks who could point to a dossier of more successful clandestine operations than any operative in perhaps the history of the agency. That resume would protect him. There wasn't a person at Langley who would dare lock horns with him, and only a handful of politicians on the Hill who would even consider taking such a risk. Not that this most recent incident would offer them any real opportunity. Rapp was a hero, and Americans loved their heroes. As her predecessor Thomas Stansfield had taught her, Kennedy suppressed the desire to get Rapp on the phone and read him the riot act. It would be better to cool her emotions and let him sweat it out for a while, maybe even the entire long flight home. No, Kennedy would let the one woman who truly mattered to him take care of things. It didn't matter how good Mitch was. His little powder keg of a bride was going to kick his ass like it had never been kicked before. It would almost be worth it to bug his house just to hear the interrogation. No matter what Rapp said or did, he could not lie his way out of what he had done. He couldn't hide behind national security because Kennedy wasn't going to let him. And unless he kept his clothes on for the next month, there was no way he was going to be able to hide the fact that he'd been shot. In an effort to keep up her newfound friendship with Mrs. Rapp, she called Anna shortly before 6 a.m. and told her that the mission was a success and that her husband would be on his way home shortly. Anna, grateful for the call, thanked the director of the CIA profusely. Kennedy, in return, thanked Anna for being so understanding and told her to call if she had any questions. This sudden coziness between his boss and wife would give the intensely private and compartmentalized Rapp reason for pause once he found out about it. Kennedy took a certain amount of devious comfort in that and in the fact that Rapp would be dreading how to explain what had happened.
This ends Disc 6.